You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, December 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, filling in for our regular Friday guy, who will be joining us on Tuesday, the wonderful Uber blogger and founder of Hullabaloo, the writer for Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton, giving us, and I think this is actually, we did this last year, our annual year in review with Digby. Also on the program today, film guy Matthew and Isabel Gillies will be here to give us our end of the year film suggestion thing. Meanwhile, just how much does the DNC want to make sure that Bernie Sanders does not do well in Iowa? We've got a debate on Saturday night where, I mean, there literally is no other time or day. I guess you could do it at 3 in the morning if you wanted less people to watch. And now the DNC has pulled their voter file from the Sanders campaign over an ostensible data breach, a function of a vendor, and just a really questionable response to this, folks. Really questionable. Meanwhile, budget deal passes just moments ago in the House. Bad policy, not necessarily the worst one could expect, considering Democrats don't control either Senate or the House. But it certainly should put to bed the notion that the Republicans, all they care about is the deficit, as opposed to tax cuts. Meanwhile, Scott Walker shatters the nonpartisan voter rules in Wisconsin. Really despicable. Really despicable. And equally despicable, although not necessarily a reality quite yet in Ohio, but it's really disgusting. We'll talk to Cliff about this next week, but an Ohio bill would require women to bury aborted and miscarried fetuses.
As I said to you this morning, it's basically stalker legislation almost.
What the
it's
frick
bizarre.
Is wrong with these people?
It's creepy.
Now, you'll recall, like, I mean, this is a bit, I mean, look, I mean, it's quite, it's not that bizarre. I mean, to the extent that I can understand why they would do this, it is to pretend that a fetus is like a person, or not like a person, that a fetus is a person, that an embryo is a person. And do you got to do this for fertilized eggs? Should we bury the menstrual cycle of women? I mean, of unfertilized eggs, rather? Even, I guess, fertilized eggs, right? I mean, there are some that don't attach to...
Right.
That don't attach and get passed. We should... I mean, they're fertilized eggs. They're not going to incubate, I guess, or grow. I'm not sure what the word, what the term is, but there's at least a couple. Generally, we don't know. I mean, maybe we should send in a search and rescue team to examine menstruations, just to make sure there's no fertilized egg in there, and to, I guess, bury it. Get a little coffin and bury it. Rick Santorum made a very big deal about this back, I think it was in 2012. Maybe it was before that. I can't remember. That he, when his wife had a miscarriage, they brought the fetus home, gathered the kids around, and buried, had a funeral for the fetus. So it is a thing with them. Part of it is because, not part of it, I think a big part of it is that Attorney General Mike DeWine in Ohio was trying to go after Planned Parenthood over the supposed baby harvesting that they're doing. Sort of like that blood libel thing a little bit when you start to think about it. So it's a little bit about that blood libel, which, of course, is true. We don't do this for Hanukkah, but I think it's for Passover. It's a Jewish tradition to get a small Christian child in and drink their blood. And
they're getting more and more expensive every year. I went to what they're put. They're charging in Zabar's is through the roof. It's unbelievable.
You've got
Matt would have made a very nice Christian baby to sacrifice from the heartland. Very pure.
Well, that's the thing. Is it in New York? You've got to order well in advance. If you live outside of New York City, it's almost like it's literally like you get your pick.
And the other thing,
but if you're in New York, you've got to order in advance because there's a lot of places that will just sell out.
And also, you know, Jews are all over the place here, so really finding like a pure grade Christian blood is not as straightforward as you
very
might think
difficult.
It would be.
Very difficult.
So it's better to take a trip out of town. I'm not going to tell you where I go because I don't want it to get clustered, but it's better that way.
That's right. But just, I don't know, it's insane. And this is, there's a Pew poll out right now. Well, you know, let's just go to Digby. We'll talk to Digby about that because it's rather insane. We, just a reminder, folks, it's the end of the year. Next week, what we're going to have is three new shows. I don't know if they will all be live, but we'll have three new shows. And then we'll start our best ofs. Do we have any more time? I mean, if people came in with a late-breaking, really good idea of best ofs, we would look at it. I mean, but...
if they want to help their chances, put the date on it. If you're going to come this late to the deadline, I think that's...
That's right. Do Matt a favor, will you? So send us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And also, I will remind you that your reviews on iTunes are very helpful to us. Very helpful to us. We got a lot of things planned for the new year. When we come back, our set is going to look radically different, I guess. When we come back, we're going to be doing surveys because we're going to start to mix up things a little bit. And we're going to have, hopefully, a new membership service and just system that may not impact you guys as much as it will us. But it'll when we don't have to spend hours on one thing, we can spend hours on another thing. And we've got a couple of new podcasts that we're going to be releasing. They're in the hopper, as it were, and going to come out.
The hopper, dude.
And we've got a lot of things planned for 2016. So give us a review on iTunes. If you can, support the program by become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you buy stuff from Amazon, the least you can do, skim some of the profit away from Jeff Bezos and give it to us. And, I will also say we're going to do a review of the Democratic debate. It's taking place Saturday night, but we will do a review. It's going to be in New Hampshire. We will do a review of it on Monday. All right, take a quick break. We'll be right back with Digby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always a huge pleasure for me to welcome one of my favorite bloggers, writers, certainly blogs for over a decade now. Oh, my God. Ladies and gentlemen, the Uber blogger and writer for Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Hello, Heather.
Hey, Sam.
So,
thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. And you know, I think we did this last year too, where we did a look back on the year that was. It's 2015. It's a little bit earlier than normal, just because I don't know when Christmas falls and all that other stuff. But let's start with a topic that I know that you've written quite a bit about, and it is. There's a lot of topics actually that intersect with this, and I just did a story about this bill that they're proposing in Ohio to force women who have had abortions or miscarriages, and they introduce it. I don't know that it's going to pass. To force those women to essentially either agree to bury or cremate their fetus. It all ties into essentially the attacks on Planned Parenthood that took place via video camera this year, as opposed to guns. There's so many different issues wrapped up in this, but it's certainly a stalwart from the right, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's funny because I think. We've seen this, you know, what the Democrats called the war on women in the 2012 and 2024 campaigns. It's obviously not going away, this particular crusade against Planned Parenthood. And some of that, I think, has to do with the fact I've just noticed that the energy behind the Planned Parenthood and the anti-abortion movement has really ratcheted up since the marriage equality issue was resolved in the Supreme Court. I mean, not that they are resigned to it by any means, but it seems as though there is this sense, you know, they kind of are acting like cornered animals and you know, lashing out blindly at women's rights, and I think that that has something to do with it. There's, and you know, maybe that even, as you say, this intersects a lot of different areas that we talk about and that, you know, are, we deal with in our politics and our culture. Social conservatives kind of feel like they've been set back on their heels, and they are regrouping and launching a major assault in this direction. There is some reason, I think, for them to believe, just in the, on the basis of how fast marriage equality became, a, you know, a majority, a big majority, you know, acceptance among the people, and that this is the area, this is the issue that continues to keep their people engaged, and which is the one where they can really focus their energies and you know, and try to actually make some progress. And as we know, they have been for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, at least since 2010, when they won their big, you know, midterm election in the states around the country, they have been absolutely, they have been launching one assault on women's rights and particularly reproductive rights after another. And they've been quite successful in doing that. I mean, this has been just, you know, chipping away at it over and over again. It's made it even to the Supreme Court, where they, you know, have been, you know, using these arcane laws in the various states to try and limit women's access to abortion, as in the case in Texas that was heard before the Supreme Court. So, you know, there's their tactics on this are, have been to chip away at it in the 50 states, and you know, just try and limit it as much as possible. But this year we've seen this explosion that came out of these hoax videos that were done by this, you know, this group, this sort of James O'Keefe style group. And in fact, I think they have some there are areas in which they've intersected as well,
right,
with it, with these hoax videos that were done by this, what do they call it, Center for Medical Progress,
and
this, you know, by half.
And we should say, like, this guy, the people involved in this video thing, they sort of, like, this was a 2-year thing running, right? I mean, they started going to conferences, they started to introduce themselves as, like, you know, medical researchers and whatnot. So this is a long time coming. Let me ask you, too, if you think, I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm convinced about in terms of why we've seen such a rise of Islamophobia in this country that predates San Bernardino and even predates the Boston Marathon bombing, I think a lot of that is a function of Barack Hussein Obama, and you don't even need the Hussein part, I think, for them to for that to generate a rise in Islamophobia. I mean, we played this horrible clip from a Virginia town meeting where an Arab American was introducing the sort of the architectural plans for a mosque. And guys in the audience got up and said, "You people are terrorists. You're all Muslims are all terrorists. And the president's ruining the country." And, like, you know, like, as if these two sentiments necessarily came from the same sort of wellspring. And it occurs to me that both the absence of this other socially conservative issue, like you mentioned, marriage equality, but also the potential of the first woman president are driving this, that it is, like, you know, that that so much of the abortion issue is a function of women's sovereignty, not just over their body when they are pregnant, but over their body in terms of, like, having sex, right? You know, the idea of this sort of, you can have sex without any consequences. You're not punished at all for the sex you're engaging in. It's disgusting and wrong and morally wrong, is tied in very much to the idea that we could have our first woman president.
Oh, I think you're right about that. I hadn't actually thought about that. But now that you mention it, it does seem like the same dynamic is in play. I mean, these things are always, they kind of exist sort of, you know, bubbling beneath the surface. But when at the prospect of the country being led by a, you know, Barack Obama, the first black president, you see the, you know, and they weren't allowed to completely let go of their you know, racist id about African Americans. So, you know, there was a lot of transfer and transference between the Muslim and African-American thing. And let's not forget, you know, there is a long tradition in America of African-Americans becoming Muslims and being Muslims. I mean, well, Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, this is a, you know, this is, there's an association there.
Malcolm X.
Yeah, Malcolm X, in some, you know, sort of subterranean part of the conservative id, that you know, there is an association there. So here you have the prospect of the first woman president, and one who is, you know, has been associated for, you know, decades with women's rights, and you know, certainly has been, you know, pro-choice, and sort of represents all of this stuff that they are, you know, very very afraid of, to be honest. And the idea
the young ones here in this office do not remember that really her first introduction to America was her saying, "I'm not going to sit in the kitchen and bake cookies all day," and boy,
It was like she had launched a grenade into the political system when she said that. It made people so angry. It was so bad that she ended up having to offer up her personal cookie recipe to Good Housekeeping or something to prove that she did actually make cookies. And she has always been, you know, seen as the sort of feminist succubus on the right, and you know, an avatar of everything that they, you know, the feminazis, as Rush Limbaugh used to say it. So within that group, I mean, it is hard to remember. You know, Clinton's been, for young people, I think they see her as a leader, and she's been a senator and a secretary of state. But there was a time when she was the most famous woman in America for being a feminist, you know, sell out to all of womanhood. I mean, you know, she was the enemy of the Phyllis Schlafly's of America.
They, well, she's the one who tarnished the idea of first lady, right?
Yes.
Right. I mean, she was the first lady who would not accept the sort of the term of being a lady in the way that, you know, was perceived. And, you know, and before people get, you know, too uptight, this is not an endorsement of her politics. This is who she represented to the right. And I think, you know, that's still there. And, you know, look, at the end of the day, you boil it down. When you're talking about abortion, it really is just about the idea of women, of men not owning women's sexual parts anymore. I mean, that's basically what this all comes down to, is that women are no longer chattel for men. And the
giveaway is the birth control issue.
Right.
I mean, this happens every time. You know, you see this, you know, when they make any headway on the abortion issue and you know, all of their care and concern for the life and the personhood and the fetus. And then, you drill down a little bit, and they're also against birth control. And they also are, you know, they're saying, well, this kind of birth control is, even though it's scientifically completely untrue, this kind of birth control is
abortion.
You know, what they call abortifacient. You know, this it shows that what this really is about is sexuality. And this, you know, this comes in some cases from religion. It comes in some cases from, you know, patriarchy and you know, male, you know, the sense that women are you know, seeking equality and becoming, you know, they're no longer, you know, they're sovereign, you know, humans,
right,
who are actually, you know, running their own lives and making their own decisions. And, you know, they consider that a threat to the family, the basic unit of, you know, human organization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this is all tied in together. And, you know, what I see is kind of a you know, in on the right in terms of this Planned Parenthood thing, which, by the way, they are not giving up. If anybody thinks that the Planned Parenthood assault in the Congress is going away, You know, think again, because it is not going away. They are still going, they're going to have some show trials next year on Planned Parenthood. There is going to be, they've got this special select committee run by a bunch of Republican women who, and they call it something like, you know, the Committee for the Sanctity of the Infant Child or something insane like that. You know, it's ridiculous. And so this is not going to go away. This is going to go all the way into the fall. And it's kind of, I think I get the sense among Republican strategists that they're actually fairly nervous about it. It hasn't worked out well for them in the past few cycles. I mean, this has not been a winning, a winning strategy for them. But I think they believe that they have no choice. The social conservatives are demanding this,
right.
And that's a big chunk of the Republican electorate, and there's no getting around it. They're going to have to do something, you know, put on some kind of a show. And, you know, they'll try. They'll see if they can just bluster about and not actually do anything. But who knows how it's going to go. And in the meantime, it's really awful. Let's just say,
right.
Put that out there. It's a terrible thing.
And more broadly speaking, I mean, this is the basic dilemma. And I want to, we got a couple other things to hit here, but maybe this is a good time to sort of pivot into the whole right wing phenom for the year, and we could actually even tie in gun violence, I think, into this too, to some extent. I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, when we start to talk about these things, you start to realize, folks, that these things are all interrelated. You know, we end up talking about these things as separate issue silos in some way, but there is a threat that I think that the people on the right feel, and the ascendancy of a woman to the presidency, or the prospect of it, I think is terrifying, because that is sort of like, at least symbolically, and even more so, I think it's going to have more impact. I mean, to the extent that there was symbolism in the first African-American president, and we're going to talk about Black Lives Matter. Clearly, the implications for the Black community were not, I would say, I mean, they were positive, I think, in terms of the imagination was released in some way. But in terms of things on the ground, in terms of like the way that culture has changed, if anything, things seem to go backwards a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not going to be that way with a woman, because you've got 50% of the population. And I think that there's going to be Hillary Clinton is running this time anyways, not shying away from the fact that she's a woman, right? Like in the last election, it was, don't be motherly. Don't bring up your kids. Don't, you know, talk about being.
Right.
But I think that she's embracing it more this time. And I just think that there is a signal to society that, like, look, you know, this dynamic is dying. The women, we're 30 years out, and in some states, maybe only 10 or 15 from women not being chattel for their husbands. But this is ending. This is so there's a panic there. This also. With the dynamic that the right wing, and I think you and I have watched this, and you know, you pay attention to what's going on the right in a way that I think a lot of people who write as liberals don't, and particularly in sort of like, you know, mainstream publications, and the, you know, what was marginal 15 years ago is now seems to be basically the center of the Republican Party, both in terms of like issues, but more like even more in terms of just power, electoral power. Right. And so we see these hearings happening, which are only going to sort of heighten the implications and the importance for single women who may go out and be the biggest constituency that Hillary Clinton is going to be able to deliver.
Well, I think so, and I suspect that there are plenty of you know, smarter Republicans out there. They are in a minority at the moment, but you know, they do still exist. That they understand that it's a very risky thing. And in fact, even in one of the the reports recently, you probably recall, where they were talking about how to co-opt the Trump phenomenon. They were kind of saying, well, you know, he's got his finger on the pulse of the Republican electorate, and, you know, follow his lead in terms of, you know, this, that, and the other. But the one thing they said wasn't a good idea was to go after women and to not follow him on that, that that's just that, that that's kind of off limits. That will not happen, and it can't happen. And in fact, you see it with Marco Rubio, the alleged establishment it boy, who is flailing around madly, trying to move right as fast as he can. And one of the ways that he did it was by saying that he would not support a right to, that he supports banning abortion only in the case of threat to the life of the mother, whereas the mainstream position up until now, up until very recently, was that there was an exception for rape and incest, too. That is now, eliminating that exception is now a mainstream establishment Republican
crazy.
Position. And it's outrageous. I mean, incest. essentially, these Republicans, mainstream establishment Republicans, this isn't Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum or some other, super social conservative. This is Marco Rubio, who says that a woman, a girl, a 13-year-old girl should be forced to bear her father's child.
And that question, it's almost, with these debate moderators, it's possible that that question would not come up, but it would be incredible malfeasance. I mean, in a debate, if Marco Rubio is the Republican nominee, the idea that he's got to answer that question in front of the American public, are you going to force a 15-year-old, 14-year-old girl who has been raped by her father or her uncle to carry that pregnancy to term? He's got to answer that question in public. it's impossible for me to imagine that he doesn't get if nothing else, right? That stops everybody in their tracks.
I would think so. I would certainly hope so. That is not a majority view, by the way. In fact, the public opinion on abortion rights has been almost, flatlined since the 70s. That no minds have been changed one way or the other. The majority of Americans support abortion rights, some with limitations, a much smaller faction without any limitations, and there is a hardcore group who support banning abortion in all cases. For the most part, Americans are much more humane about this issue than the politicians on the right are, and their social conservative voters. I don't think that people, if they hear a mainstream politician like Marco Rubio say that a 14-year-old girl has to bear her, her relatives, bear her own sibling, that they are going to find that to be a humane and decent policy. I just don't think that most Americans think that way. And by the way, everybody should keep in mind that, a third of American women in their lifetimes have an abortion, and that's many, many millions of women.
Right.
And as we get further to the right on this, and this is happening all over the country as well, laws are being passed that are making women criminal for things like self-induced abortion. There was just one this past week where a woman was arrested for a self-induced abortion. Abortion is legal, it's a constitutional right, and they are saying that she harmed her fetus by trying to have an abortion. That is getting very, very close to criminalizing women for abortion, and it is getting very close to forcing these people to admit the fact that they consider women, millions and millions of women to be murderers. I don't think that's tenable. I don't think the vast majority of people in this country think that. But it's starting to get to become clarified.
Yep.
God knows, I hope that this is clarifying in a way that works for women and not against them. You never know how that's going to go. But I guess I remain an optimist that we're not the kind of country yet that wants to criminalize millions of women. Hopeful.
And I think, you know, just sort of pivoting here a little bit, you know, I think the loss of homophobia as a an electoral sort of like organizing force, which is not to say that homophobia is gone. It's just that the Republican Party really, they've lost their mojo on this issue. And it has transferred, I think, both to the question of women's sovereignty and also into sort of xenophobia. And once you start getting into and you know, and even like, you know, if you break down, because, you know, the Trump Cruz Carson sort of appeal here, it is, in my estimation, it is, and the Carson is different, I think, in some ways from Cruz and Trump in particular. But he raises this too. It is the whole anti-PC thing. And what is PC but sort of a recognition, but the opposite of xenophobia and the notion that women are people too?
Yep.
Right? I mean, you know, 90% of what they would complain was PC is criticism of xenophobia, racism, and misogyny. I don't even know what the other 10% is. Maybe it's all 100%. Maybe I'm forgetting something. And this is, that to me seems to be the number one organizing principle of the conservative movement. I mean, you know, I was on, I don't even know what show it was on MSNBC. They don't even have names for them anymore, I think. but it was with the libertarian guy, Matt Welsh, I think his name is. And, you know, he was saying, you know, but Donald Trump, he doesn't have, you know, conservative policy. Yes, he does. He's an a-hole who is who's basically a nativist. That is the organizing principle, right? It's like this anti-PC. They don't care about his Medicaid. Well, they probably care about him protecting Medicare and Social Security, but they don't care about the intricacies of any policy, as far as I can tell, as long as it basically follows and adheres to that notion of, A, we're going to, you know, brown people are not white people, and B, if you criticize me for saying that, it's you who is being bigoted, which is the anti-PC thing. And then there's a sort of overlay of republicanism, which is I'm a billionaire, so I'm necessarily right. And that's it. You know, like I'm right morally. I'm right. I know more than any of the government stooges, blah, blah, blah. And that's Trump. And that's really the Republican Party in many respects now.
Oh, absolutely. And it's neat how Trump kind of encapsulates all of that, you know, because you think of him, he's got this populist appeal, you know, or some of us might call it a fascist appeal.
Right.
But, you know, he's the leader of the everyman, right? And yet, of course, he's a billionaire, which in America is considered, you know, that among Republicans, that has been pounded into their heads over and over again, that great wealth is kind of a sign of moral superiority, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the Pope.
That you are,
he's like the Pope.
Yeah, he's like the Pope. He's a billionaire. Of course, he's the greatest. And, you know, everything you just said is so true. Let me just, I just want to read this thing. This is Marco Rubio. Again, I come back to Rubio because I think he's kind of a bellwether of how, you know, of what the party is seeing as they're trying to work
right.
their way through the election here. His latest ad says this: "This election is about the essence of America, about all of us who feel out of place in our own country, a government incredibly out of touch and millions with traditional values branded bigots and haters. This is about wages growing slower, a generation drowning in debt, and a president humiliated by Putin, Iran, and Islamic jihadists. I'm Marco Rubio. I approve this message because this is about the greatest country of the world and acting like it." I mean, that last line is so awkward.
Yes.
I don't know. Oh, my God. But, you know, this is this thing where he says it's about the essence of America, about all of us who feel out of place in our own country, and a government out of touch with millions with traditional values who are branded bigots and haters. I mean, that is a direct appeal to those Trump voters who are, you know, all the PC stuff, you know, just, you know, see, we're not really bigots and haters. They're just saying that about us. You know, we're the traditional America. We're the essence of America. You know, that's got to be the appeal to this core group in the Republican Party who are going toward the Trumps or Cruz or I guess Ben Carson, at least at some point in the past, they seem to be falling off of him. But that's that group, and it's big. It's over 50% of this Republican electorate. And I think that's one of the things people don't really realize.
Yeah.
When you add up Trump, Cruz, Carson, and now Christie with, you know, the fact that he's jumped on the crazy train talking about shooting Russian planes out of the sky and, you know,
but
World War III and
that
stuff.
Still is a little bit different. I mean, there's the machismo there, but I mean, I think like that's low rent machismo, I think, in my mind. He doesn't
it
have
it is. I do think it's a cheap appeal to try and peel
and
off
it's,
some of
and it's not
people.
Durable. I don't think, you know, I think like, you know, the 9/11 thing is just, it's not terribly durable, I don't think, for Christie. I mean, it's one thing for him to go to New Hampshire, and now he's at 11 points in New Hampshire.
Ooh.
In fourth or fifth place. I mean, honestly, he's been spending literally more time there than in his home state. You know, at one point it just becomes like, I just feel bad for the guy. It's, you know, if this gets him out of our living room, let's vote for him. But but yes.
Yeah, the fact is, though, if you add all those people together, you're talking about 70% of the Republican electorate are in one regard or another being drawn in by this idea that they're a besieged minority who are, you know, losing everything at the hands of Muslims and Mexicans and women and, you know, all of this, you know, Barack Obama and liberals and, you know, the whole panoply of the enemy list that they have. And that is where they're at. And it's a lot of people. It's very big. I don't think it's a majority. But I mean that's what what they're stuck with. That's what the Republican Party is stuck with. And of course, you know, I don't feel sorry for them. They created this. I feel sorry for us because what this is doing is basically pushing the entire conversation off the edge. I mean, we're not having a presidential campaign about anything real. I mean, this is just kind of a primal scream.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, I want to preface this by saying, to be fair, and I don't feel a need to be fair, but these people are losing something. I mean, they are losing essentially, I mean, this has been just a slow burn, frankly, for 150, 70 years, but they are losing the fact that they were, for a long time, in this country's history, at least at the founding, Uber citizens, right? Like, there was all these other people here, but there was one group that basically could own people outright, could own them once they married them, could own them literally to work on their stuff, to get their free labor. And now, you know, it's slow burn and we've got some way to go, but they are losing that. And, there's a couple of different responses to that. And there, and the Republican Party has nurtured one response, which is, to see this as an injustice to them and to see everyone, all these other people as in some way, dirty, evil, uppity, whatever it is, and they're taking advantage of it, and it's fascinating to me because I still don't think that they're, and it seems to be coming around, but it's, you know, it's not Trump, it's the people who are supporting Trump.
Absolutely.
That is the story here. It just so happens that Trump is the perfect. The perfect vessel for them to put their hopes and dreams in, and or anger and hate in, and he just happened to show up. And too bad for the Republican Party. I keep saying this over and over again, but they basically built the suit, and they just,
absolutely,
you know, it just happened to be exactly Donald Trump's size.
Yep.
And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, they don't own the suit. He just takes it from them. All right. Let's also talk about what's happening with Black Lives Matter, because certainly, you know, 2015 has been about, you know, sort of an emergence. And I did an interview with a divinity school professor, history professor, about W.B. Du Bois and the Black social gospel. And you know, over the year, I've had the opportunity to talk to, you know, many people on sort of like this. There is a divide in Black intellectual life, I think, that has been, in my estimation, very underreported. And to the extent that we've seen anything written about it, it tends to be more personality driven than anything else. But Black Lives Matter has sort of grown out or in between that divide, and in some ways in response to it, and obviously in direct response to the fact that we have a policing problem. And you have been writing about the policing problem sort of broadly speaking for years, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And what has struck you about what we've seen around that whole, I guess, area?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that the you know, the policing, the over-policing that we see in America, and which has been present for quite some time, it really accelerated after 9/11. It you know, basically targets African Americans, usually young men, often young women as well. This is, or I shouldn't even say young. It doesn't, you don't have to be young to be, you know, it's just any African American. I mean, we know this. You don't have to look too far into the data to see, you know, look at the prison population, the percentage of African Americans that are in prison compared to white people versus their population in, you know, their percentage of the population. There's something wrong. Anybody with a brain has to be able to see that there is something terribly wrong with that. And in fact, one of the great sort of insights that I've seen in recent years is the idea that this was, you know, really an extension of Jim Crow. The idea that, you know, you would allow on the surface, you know, the granting of equal rights to African Americans, but, you know, they ended up being imprisoned instead. And I don't think there's, I just don't think there's any doubt about this. I mean, I suppose, you know, you can continue to argue a little bit, but it seems so obvious that I don't think that there's a point to it. But there is a bigger story that for, you know, which the African American in our country is, you know, is the most obvious victim, but it goes even beyond that, which is this idea of this overzealous policing.
Right.
We've gone into a military style of policing methods, some of that coming out of 9/11 and the Iraq War. I mean, it probably goes back before that. Some of it's driven by technology. In particular, you know, I've been writing about the problem with tasers being used as torture devices for many years.
Yes.
This is only now starting to come to the surface as maybe being a serious problem. But I've been documenting these things for years. I mean, the advent of the you know, the mobile individual video camera on phones has changed everything, and
yes,
now the police cams as well. Because I don't think that there's any doubt that police have been abusing and brutalizing people for many, many years.
Right.
But now it is, you know, it's available for us to look at. And I think in the beginning people were looking at it and going, oh, well, they must have deserved it. Then they started looking at it and going, oh, well, that's funny. You know, the tasering especially seemed to amuse a lot of people. And it's not being funny anymore. And people are starting to realize the scope of this problem, that, you know, the police training, the way they have come to police, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush here. There are tons of good cops. I mean, most
right.
of them are good cops, and they have a rough job. I mean, I think we all admit that, you know, this is not a job most of us would choose. It's, you know, it's tough, especially in a country that's armed to the teeth. You know,
right.
you have to have some sympathy for police officers out there in this shooting gallery that we have. But nonetheless, they are public servants. Their job there is to protect and serve, and this idea that they can operate with impunity is undemocratic and un-American. And there has been this feeling, and we're starting to see this as we see court cases come along and various, you know, sort of national events around these police shootings, you're beginning to see that this is a rigged game, and that cops are very, very often allowed to operate with impunity. People's lives are being lost over this, and in much greater numbers, I think, than people realize. So we're starting to see a bit of a sea change due to a lot of different things.
It's interesting because I think, you know, and it may be a fool's errand to try and sort of like parse this out, but and it may be, you know, largely irrelevant. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, I think that theory of sort of this is an extension, this is in the tradition of Jim Crow in some way, is really important, because I think you have this ongoing thing where we're basically paying a group of people. Obviously, this isn't their primary function, but this is a sort of there's a lot of subtext here to police and to subjugate one group, black people in society, and minorities, largely speaking, in society. And then, you know, you lay that in with what happened in 9/11 and sort of the police sort of like were, you know, they were given steroids in some respects. And then, like you say, the advent of camera phones is sort of like the images of those water cannons that have become so iconic, and really, in many respects, I think impacted the white community to see, like, oh, those water cannons, we paid for those water cannons that are being unleashed on just, you know, average people, black people who are marching for their rights. And I think that there's something like that is going on in this country. And I think we're just at the beginning of it in some ways.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I do too. I don't think that, you know, that we're not, we're a long way from reaching, you know, some kind of consensus about how to deal with this problem. It's very difficult. I mean, for obvious reasons, we know how deeply racism is embedded in our American culture. I mean, it's the original sin, goes all the way back to the beginning, and we have made you know, strides in equality in our society, but we are far from eliminating that as a problem. As this, our prison population and the way police and the, you know, poverty levels and all the rest of it. I mean, it just proves that we're a long way from fixing that. But, you know, the idea that, you know, this is we're getting attention to this, that there is something that is actually maybe scratching on people's consciences, is actually a good sign. It's something that I think is long, long overdue, and it's driven by a lot of factors, and it's not just the technology, although that's huge. I mean, when I first started reporting on tasers, it would be very rare that I got that I could find any video on it.
Right.
And when I did, people laughed at it. I thought, oh, right, look at that, that's funny. But now, you know, we're seeing, number one, there are tons of deaths by tasers. It's a deadly weapon. It's used for punitive purposes by cops all the time. They like to taser people who have given them lip or who have tried to run away or various other things. They use this as a punishment. That's not what tasers are designed to do, and cops do not have that right to do it. I mean, you know, like I said, there are a lot of good cops out there, but one of the things that we grant police, and I hope we continue to do it, is very generous benefits, early retirements, you know, a lot of protections in those ways. That's a tough job. They should be paid well. But the idea that they should be allowed to, you know, inflict punishment on citizens of their own volition when they want to is outrageous. Yep. And the fact that we are now equipping them with, electrical shock devices to do that, we really need to rethink that. It's an outrage.
It's insane when you think about it in that regard. All right, well, listen, we just have, I appreciate your going along with me. I'm going to skip over on my list of the marriage equality and gun violence, although I sort of feel like we've talked around gun violence, not quite there, because we've got a couple more days on this program to sort of recap 2015. But I do want to talk to you just about I think there's a lot to talk about in terms of Bernie Sanders and what he represents in the Democratic Party. But But what I really want to touch on, because you and I have talked about this before, and it's one of those stories that I think, like, just like the political press hasn't quite come around to the idea that, you know, Donald Trump is really just the mirror. He's not the story. He's just the reflection, and it's the Republican Party. Another story that I think sort of was never really flushed out, and you and I have talked about this, was sort of the post Dan Pfeiffer understanding of Obama. Will you tell people what I mean by that? Because I know you know.
Yeah. Well, Dan Pfeiffer was a top advisor to the White House and was a very intrinsic to Obama's wins in both 2008 and 2012. And I don't think there's any doubt that Dan Pfeiffer is as loyal an Obama staffer as you can find. I mean, I think he really loved the guy. And, you know, so I'm just saying that to preface what I'm about to say. When he left off, he decided to, you know, move on. It's an exhausting job working in the White House for all those years. And he decided to move on, I think it was a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago. In any case, he gave an exit interview. And one of the things that he said in that was, I think, was very important, which was that they went in there assuming that they could deal with Republicans, that this was, that there was, you know, some of that was believing their own hype, and some of it was just the idea that historically any president who comes in with a mandate of the size and scope of Obama's would be given, you know, some ability to get things done, to enact his agenda. And they tried. They tried very hard. They went all the way through, you know, the budget deals that we, I'm sure everybody remembers, you know, the Sturm und Drang of those, the Obamacare, you know, legislation, all of that. And they were met with resistance at every turn. It took them until 2012 to actually recognize that the dynamic was completely different than what they had assume. Now, I, you know, you and I know, Sam, I mean, I could have predicted that from, you know, from a decade ago, that this was where the Republicans were heading. And I never bought the idea that Obama had some, you know, special ability to transcend what I saw was happening in the Republican Party. But, you know, you can't hold it against them and say that they didn't give it the good old college try, because they did. And it did not work. And all that happened was the Republicans became more and more intransigent. And, you know, of course, one of the effects, one of the reasons for this was, is that they were winning big in these midterm elections where there was low turnout. And they were able to, you know, the Democrats lost the majority in the Senate, and the House gained this big majority. You know, the Republicans gained this big majority in the House. And you know, there were these signs coming from the Republicans, you know, this rise of the Tea Party and all of that. But I don't think that that the Obama administration understood, you know, early enough, when it was obvious that this rise of the Tea Party was a very serious matter. These people were gaining power like crazy within the party. They already held a lot of power.
That, to me, is the party. I mean, there are two things I want to add to this that occurs to me. One is that I don't think it was just a sort of like a tactical or strategic thing. I think they were open to that strategy, and I think in some ways they were blinded by the sort of the futility of that strategy, because I think that from an ideological, maybe that's not the right word, perspective, in terms of the issues that they were closer to the Republicans of yore than I think, you know, about many people hoped Obama would be. Yeah, because you've made this point time and time again that in 2008, to early 2009, before they're even inaugurated, President Obama's talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, and and was going to seek what he called entitlement reform. And so I think from where they were standing, too, they were just as hopeful as the people who think who thought that Jeb Bush was going to be the, you know, was going to be the candidate. You know, those Republicans who thought, like, oh, this is who our party is. I think, you know, because they shared that sort of issue set, that they were just as deluded in some respects as some of the Republicans. And that's why they found that their tactics were wrong. And I would also say that I don't think the Republicans necessarily reacted that way because they thought it was a good strategy. Because, you know, I think coming out of the gate, they thought, like, this guy's going to walk all over us, and he should be able to. I think that they just found that they didn't control their party in the way that they thought they did. And that this is, again, like, you know, the bottom line is, I don't care who your politicians are. If 60 or 70% of your electorate basically thinks that, you know, as long as a guy gets up there and says, I'm going to make America great and I'm going to punch Putin in the face, you know, and only I can do it because he respects me. You know, that's what you got. Like that group is going to control the politicians, not vice versa. And I think that's what we were looking at. So let me ask you this. I mean, going forward, it's not, you know, from the Democratic, potential Democratic nominees, let's, you know, with all due respect to Martin O'Malley, fans, let's consider Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I think, you know, Bernie Sanders clearly has policies that are wildly divergent, particularly on economic issues, when we the Republicans. Hillary Clinton, I think, is, you know, somewhere in between there, probably more similar in terms of her policies with Obama. But and so I know that Bernie Sanders, you know, would have no delusions about this. Do you think that Hillary Clinton going into that same situation is going to fall victim to that same thing that the Obama administration learned in the first 2 years? Or do you think that they would have a different perspective?
You know, it's very hard to know that. I honestly don't know. I mean, if you look at the history, you see that, you know, that the people who come out of the Clinton school going way back, you know, were people who had learned to compromise with Republicans. They came out of the DLC. They were among the people who created that's the Democratic Leadership Council of the late 80s and early 90s. Their entire their history and Bill Clinton's presidency was that period of Democrats trying to get away from their earlier reputation as being the McGovernites and the crazy hippies and trying to adjust to what was then an ascendant right wing. And that was the way they were looking at it. You had Reagan and then you had Gingrich, and this was a very, very powerful political movement at the time. Very different than what we have now, which is essentially a grassroots movement. They were in a power struggle, and that was how the Democrats adjusted to it. I think it's probably a mistake to assume that Clinton is going to follow that model. Times have changed. It's, you know, it's 20 years later, and I don't get the sense that she's completely unaware of, you know, the fact that it has changed. Moreover, she has been, the victim of the right wing throughout that period in a way that I think is rather unparalleled. I cannot imagine that Hillary Clinton is not aware of what the right wing is capable of. I just don't know. Now, how she deals with that, that's very difficult. When she went into the Senate, she played by the rules, and she was a good, freshman senator, and she worked with the right wing and did all these things. Her voting record was actually, substantially more liberal than Obama's was during that period. But she, she played the Senate game and did, that kind of thing. And she doesn't appear to be somebody who holds grudges. What that means, I don't know. But I do know this. I mean, I don't think there's any choice. I think it is. I don't think there's any sense that Republicans will even mildly pretend. I mean, I could see them boycotting the inauguration.
Yeah.
I could absolutely see them doing that. I could see people refusing to come to the State of the Union that she is speaking at, and, members of Congress, and just, well, I won't even show up there. I mean, that is the level that they're at. So even if Hillary Clinton has some illusion in her mind that she can work with Republicans or come in with some grand bargain in her head that she could do, I mean, I haven't seen any evidence that she's thinking along those lines. But if she did, it would be an instant slap in the face. There is no chance on earth that these people will even remotely pretend that they're willing to work with her. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, over these 8 years, I mean, whoever, regardless who becomes the president, and hopefully it will not be a Republican, people have to remember they've gone from, nominating and picking Sarah Palin as the VP to basically, and it's still early in the process, but it's quite possible they just may more or less nominate, you know, everything that that made Sarah Palin Sarah Palin in 2016. I mean, so that's just a sense of like where for president, and that's where they have gone. But Digby, I could talk to you for hours more, but I know that you've got things to do. I really appreciate your taking the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
And
thanks for having me, Sam, and have a great New Year.
You too, and a happy holidays, and even Christmas.
Yes,
I'm even
going
to say
Christmas.
The words Christmas to you, Digby.
As much as I hate it, as much as I want to destroy everything about it.
I know.
For those of you who still believe, okay, well, enjoy.
We will hopefully talk to you many times in 2016. Thanks again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bye-bye. Sam. Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When I come back, Isabel Gillies and Matthew Film Guy. God, it's like Matt is like taking me on this like sort of walk down memory lane all the time. I love it. The Cure. Oh my God. That is like I remember exactly where I was when I was playing that album. 1984, maybe 85. First year of college. Right? Am I right on that?
I had no idea it was that old, actually.
All right. Grandpa will be quiet now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce the next two people on this program who have been our stalwart film recommenders for years now, and we always like to bring them together for an end of the show, the end of the year show, where they get a chance to, you know, finally talk to each other, rebut each other, argue with each other, throw vindictive insults at each other, and whatnot. But before that happens, I've got to introduce each one individually. Ladies and gentlemen, our first guest is someone who inspired this theme song by Jimmy Reefer Cake.
Today is casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Hello, Isabel. How are you?
Hello.
All right.
Hello and happy holidays to you.
Oh, well, that is so kind of you to say, to know that I vehemently do not celebrate Christmas. Isabel, hold on for 1 second, because it's not just you today. It's a holiday festival. It's a festive holiday.
A festival of lights.
We're going to introduce our next movie weekly almost, or bi-monthly movie recommender whose theme song was he had commissioned himself. A little bit weird, but you know, nevertheless, here it is.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, film guy.
Yes, Matthew. Yes, Matthew Film Guy had his own head-banging song commissioned. Matthew, are you there?
Hi, this is Matthew Film Guy. I am sorry I cannot make it, but you should watch... and have a wonderful holiday season.
Yes, sadly, ladies and gentlemen, it turns out Matthew Film Guy could not make it today. However, he did. Wow.
I hope the force is with him.
I appreciate the fact that you knocked him in his absence, Isabel. That's the kind of spirit I like to hear from you. Matthew may join us next week. I'm not sure if we can get him on for a little bit of time next week. So it's just you, Isabel. But you know what? To be honest,
I respect opening day, opening show. I respect it if you're going to do that.
He is right now literally in the theater watching. They got tickets for the 12 o'clock. He and his fiance of what? Like it's now it seems like it's been 17 years. They've been engaged. But they're at, what is the name of the Star Wars movie?
The Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens.
Oh, yeah. It's very cool. It's very cool. I'm not going to see it, probably.
It has a pro-organic food message, Isabel.
Why are you not
going to
see it? Don't your kids want to see it?
Well, guess what? They're going by themselves.
Wow. It has happened.
It's happened.
The Force has awakened in them, if you will.
It has. And here's the cool thing is that they are... doing Star Wars all day, all the time now. So now they're you know, watching 6, 5, 4, whatever it is, and then the prequel. It's going to be all Star Wars weekend.
Oh, so they're doing a marathon, in other words.
They're doing a marathon up until the day that they see it.
Wow, that is... Myla, I just got into Star Wars about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and for Hanukkah... and she bought us tickets to go see it on Sunday. So we're
That's
going.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's just when your kid buys you like to go out, that's awesome.
Well, then my job is going to be
my
done.
Money anyways, but what's that? What do you mean?
Well, the purpose of Matthew and I being here is to recommend entertainment because you can't can't go out, but now you can because your kid's buying you tickets to the real movies.
So rare, though. So rare. And, this is not the movie I would go to the theater with. Don't tell her that I said that.
Well, don't see. There's a couple I would not see. There are a couple I would see, but this is all in the movie theater stuff, so.
Yeah, I wouldn't see it. Now, Isabel, my understanding is that your phone just fell out the window. Is that right?
Okay, so that happened, all right? So this
now,
is
wait,
what happened.
Did you go down and get it?
No, yeah, okay. So I have an OtterBox on my phone, which I get mightily made fun of, first of all, because it looks like actually the Stormtrooper outfits, but on a phone case.
Okay, so you have an OtterBox, which is a massive phone case.
Massive phone case. People laugh at me, but I'm always like, well, laugh you, because my phone is always cool and doesn't ever get hurt and it doesn't ever anything. But it does get a little gunky sometimes. It gets a little, because it's got a lot of rubber on it, so it gets a little, like, kind of grimy. So this morning, I was feeling sort of proactive, and I said, you know what? I'm going to give this thing a good wash. Took off the OtterBox, and then I washed it for real, like a big wash in the sink. And I was like, you know what? I better dry this.
Wait a
really
second.
Dry it, or else.
Isabel, you know you're not supposed to put your phone in water, right? You know that.
hey, oh, man, no, you watched took
the,
it off.
Oh, you watched the...
I took it off. Oh, you, I watched the Otterbox.
Okay, you watched your... Okay, okay, okay.
I was like, you know what? Let's. I heard something about that your toilet seat's way cleaner than your phone case, and my phone case was so big. I was like, I better wash this. So I washed it, being responsible. Then I put it, and I even took a dish towel, put it on the sink thing, and I was drying it. Cut to, so I have this very little skinny, now it's like a 5 or something. It's small and skinny, right? The iPhone. So a friend calls. I'm coming in from walking the dog, and I had opened the windows in this temperate weather, but then it got a little chilly today. So I stood up on the radiator to close the window. It's hard to imagine, but I'm up, you know, high, pushing the window up, open, to close it. And the phone falls off my ear, and then it was like, am I, you know, Mission Impossible. It just went, it just fell through in between the two windows. I can't describe it, like where it goes up and down. I have old-fashioned windows, and it was so skinny, and it just fell.
Through the slot between your double-hung windows.
Yes.
Without the case on because you were washing it.
Because I was washing it. Had it had the Otterbox, that thing couldn't have gotten through that little slit. But it didn't, so it fell and crashed many, many, many stories down.
Wow. 8 floors, wasn't it?
Yup.
And so...
And I was like, what? And here's the thing about when your phone falls.
Did someone get hurt? I mean, did you check and see if it landed on anybody?
Yeah, no, because it was in the back. It's in the back, so thank God. Thank God.
Yes.
That would kill somebody. But... So there's a million different lessons here, but
I would start with when you're trying to stand on a radiator, open the window, don't have the phone on your ear. What do you mean on your ear? Like, did you have
it?
Like
in between your phone, your ear, and your shoulder.
Who does that with an iPhone, anyways? How can you do that? I literally just tried to mock doing that, and I think I pulled something.
But let me tell you, I grew up in the 70s. That's how we spoke on the phone.
Yeah, I know. But Isabel, I also grew up in the 70s. And those phones you're talking about were like 4 or 5 inches thick. And they had handles. And they were tethered to something.
This is why it fell and why it went through the slit. And it was like a comedy of errors. Except that now, in 1 second, you're like, oh my goodness. I have you couldn't text me. Like, in 1 second, I became completely, like I was in 1984. I became a 14-year-old. I was like, well, no one can get in touch with me. I don't even have an answering machine.
Oh, my God. And
what am I going to do? I was, like, looking at the dog, like, well, I didn't know anybody's number. I don't have anybody. My kids can't text. I'm like, rendered a noodle.
I'm surprised you're even just sitting there. Like, I'm surprised you haven't run out to like an AT&T or something, or wherever it is you go.
Believe me, I thought about it.
Did you run down to like the Apple store and were like, I need to have a phone?
I didn't have time because you were about to call.
So this just happened seconds ago.
This happened. Why am I even talking about it? It might bore everybody to tears, but it just happened. So I'm traumatized.
Do you have a picture?
I even tweeted it.
I was going to say, how did you tweet it?
On my computer.
Oh, right. Okay. It's too bad because I was going to say, take a picture of it and send it to us and we'll post it. But you don't have any way to take a picture anymore, do you? Because you don't have a phone.
And I don't have a camera.
All right, Isabel.
I'm just like, I might as well just be sitting here. I might as well, like my Christmas tree, just sitting here looking pretty without it, to be able to speak to anybody.
I don't know. I don't know what that means, but about your Christmas tree. But so, Isabel, just give us a look back, just very briefly. 2015, good year for you, bad year for you? Are you looking forward
very
to 2016?
Very good year, very good year. Everyone's doing great. We're really entering. It was my eldest child's 14th birthday, so he's now solidly a real teenager, and that's all good. I love teenagers, as everybody who knows me a little bit knows.
Well, you're a tween author, and maybe you become a teen author.
Well... No, I don't think so. But next two projects don't really have anything to do with that. But looking back, everything was very good. I sort of can't remember what happened. If there's, I can't remember. I'm so caught up in what's happening all now. But it was a good year. It was a good year. I'm excited for 2016. I'm excited for the campaign. I'm a little freaked out, you know, as everyone is. I'm a little heavy-hearted about the state of affairs.
Still. Hi, Isabel.
Hi, Matt.
It's Michael.
Hi, new Matt.
Why?
Yeah, whatever.
Wow, she really does not know my voice.
Whatever. It really doesn't matter.
Actually, that hurts.
I'm in a state of like a little bit of heightened panic.
Oh, don't blame it on the iPhone. It's okay though. But I'm curious.
Okay.
Are you still leaning towards Trump self comfort as a candidate
that
or no?
That was so terrible that people even put it on Twitter. They're like, oh, she likes Trump, and it's just I can't even believe it. All I said was
he's comfortable in his instrument.
Yeah, that's what I said. I said the guy's willing to say, like, I don't believe a sister, you know? And so everyone in the world is like, well, not in the world, but a lot of people in America are like, yeah, neither do I.
Willing to say what?
He said that he was being interviewed, and they were like, well, how can you say that about, you know, all Muslims, like the San Bernardino people? They were like, what about the sister who doesn't know anything? And he was like, well, I don't believe a sister.
Okay.
And that just sounds like what any average Joe would say.
Do you believe the sister?
I don't know. I don't know anything. All I know is that that's what all I said. And then everybody said that I like Trump, and it hurt my feelings. Didn't like it. I don't like Trump.
Okay. All right. You don't have to, you don't have to justify that to us. We believe it.
I know.
We believe you don't like Trump.
No, you seem more, a little, maybe more Cruz.
Oh, my God. I'm such an easy target. I have no good comebacks. Go Hillary. Go Bernie. Go anyone.
She's covering herself.
But those people.
Why are you dissing Martin O'Malley?
Yeah, I think he's done some good things too, right?
See,
no?
How about that? I'm just going to get caught in like I'm in a
Isabel,
sticky toffee pudding.
What was your favorite movie of this year that you saw?
Can I do it in the real movie theater? Or does it have to
be
Netflix?
Yes, just any movie. Because that's any movie you saw this year is probably going to end up in... Yeah.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say Grandma.
Grandma?
I'm
going to
say with Lily Tomlin. It was so good.
Okay.
I'm going to say Brooklyn.
Brooklyn,
I adored Brooklyn. I adore it.
I just got a SAG free download.
Screener?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good.
Brooklyn, okay. Grandma.
I almost just ruined it for everybody. But I can do the Irish. It's Irish. Oh, Aisha.
Okay, so Brooklyn and Grandma.
Brooklyn, Grandma. Let's also do, you got to stretch back. You got to stretch back in your memory.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't count. What was in the summer? What were some blockbusters?
I don't know.
Did I see anything in the summer that
Did
I
you
liked?
See Dope, Isabel? That wasn't a blockbuster. Did you see Dope?
Have you seen the new Bond?
No,
is that good? Okay.
I think you would really like Dope, Isabel. It's a great movie.
What about The Martian? What about that one?
I saw The Martian. Yeah. I quite enjoyed The Martian. I liked The Martian a lot. I was sort of happy in it. I was like, I'm fine.
Right.
You know, I'm fine to be on Mars. I'm quite happy here for 2 hours.
All right, so let's Brooklyn and Grandma. I mean, those are the
Brooklyn
two.
Brooklyn and Grandma. Grandma is really, really good. And that is, I hope Lily Tomlin wins a big fat Oscar for that. And Brooklyn is just, if you see one film in the next week while everybody's on break, just go run, don't walk to Brooklyn.
Okay.
It's so good. I saw it twice in the movie theater.
Jog.
Within 4 days.
All right. Wow. All right. Fair enough.
How about that?
Okay. Well, so what else? What should we watch now going into the new year?
Okay. This is a little, because here's what happened. Hanukkah happens. Thanksgiving happens. My kid's birthday happens. I'm eating a lot, I have to tell you.
Okay.
And I'm maybe tipping the scales. And so what I do for that is I walk because I can't run because my knees are trashed. So I walk. And what I'm going to recommend is not a movie.
What?
Because it's the thing that I've been into, but it's entertainment.
You're not going to tell me you're into audiobooks.
No, Remember one time when I recommended The Goldfinch, a book, and actually it was good and people liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of like this, and I'm just it's a very popular thing, but I
is
just going to
be some
I,
type of meditation thing or something. No.
Ready?
Yeah.
It's season 2 of Serial.
Wait a second. You've told me for years that you don't know how to listen to podcasts on your phone.
Right, but I just started. Season 2, it only has 2 episodes.
Wait a second, Isabel. You don't even listen to this show. You don't listen to this show. You're listening to Serial?
Yeah, I'm listening to Serial. I'll tell you why. It's a story, and it's in... And can I tell you the first time I listened to it? It was in a car.
Wait a second. You're listening to podcasts in the car? You don't listen to this podcast?
I only listen to Serial.
But there's only been 2 episodes. What are you doing the rest of the time?
That's what I'm here to tell you. That's what I'm here to say. It's a story.
So in other words, you're basically saying, why don't you say you should listen to the David Pakman show? Why not go full on directly to our competition?
Hey, Serial's not your competition.
Excuse me. Apparently, you don't have time to listen to us because you're too busy listening to Serial.
No, you're like, okay, you're like live radio.
No, we are a podcast. No, we are a podcast.
Wow.
Wait a minute. Can I just tell you something? When I say what I'm doing in the day, if I'm going on Majority Report, I say I'm going on the radio.
Great. Good. I mean, we do play on radio, but we also, we have... tens of thousands of people who listen to us as a podcast.
Oh. Well,
and you're like actually a part of the show.
And you know what? In many
it's kind
respects,
of unbelievable.
It's like, it just feels like.
This is Michael,
not,
by the
not
way.
Not that we have thousands of people listening to the podcast. It just feels like we don't have one person listening to the podcast. I don't see the thousands now. I just see the one who's not.
Would you say that Serial?
When I look in the back end of our podcast and I look at our data, all it says is, Isabel's listening to Serial.
It says we have
how
new...
many downloads? How many downloads do we have today? We had one less than we would have, but for Isabel listening to Serial.
Isabel, no, would you say that Serial is a fantastic podcast, an excellent podcast, the best?
I don't even count it as a podcast.
What do you count
what?
It as? Other than
know.
It being
like
the most prominent podcast in the country.
A story?
Oh my God! I'm like getting screwed on this one. It doesn't count as a podcast because it's not every single day. It only comes out once a week.
Somebody just IM'd me. I just saw it. It just flashed up there. I didn't read the whole thing.
Oh no!
But
don't
it was basically,
insult me. I'm so...
It's not an insult to you. It is not an insult to you. It is somebody just. All I saw was. Chicken wings and Super Bowl party. And it is very close to that. And I feel like this is the same situation. Like I feel like you've structured your whole life just to come on here and sort of like subtly insult me.
And Isabel, Michael again here, we have to deal with the emotional fallout from this. Like you can just get off of the phone and then we have to deal with Sam's morose pain.
I'm going to be walking around
suffering.
This office just like.
It's really uncomfortable to see him not freaking out about Social Security.
Listen, something that happens every day. I don't go on and say, "Oh, you know what you should do?
You don't
do?
Have
you
to listen
to Brian
every
Lara.
Day. You don't have to listen to this every day.
Maybe once a week."
You are not a story that begins, middles, and ends.
Excuse me. How would you know?
Because I know. Because
I do an interview every day. Michael does one once a week. That have. I mean, I certainly. Can tell you that
it is not the same.
We're chronicling America.
I create a narrative structure with the when I enter an interview. Yes, I have an inciting event that happens about.
I try so hard to think of something
10 minutes
interesting
in
and to say.
Serial.
No, Michael here again. I think you actually would enjoy this show if you gave it a shot.
No, maybe you wouldn't. Oh,
maybe she wouldn't. That's true.
All it is she's reporting on Bo Bergdahl. This is not a fictional story. What stories do you think we tell here? We cover Bo Bergdahl. We didn't do.
It's. Oh my God! I just tanked it on the last. You know, this is all Matthew's fault. It's Matthew Film Guy's fault.
Yeah, Matthew's too busy, probably listening to some other podcast right now.
He no. He's spending a lot of money listening to going to the movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I at least said something that's free.
Hey, Isabel, this is new Matt. I wanted to say...
Hey, new Matt. Hey. Can you just do something? Say something
heart
nice
is,
to
His heart
me?
Is broken.
Yeah, I'm gonna come to your defense here because last Thank time you you recommended The Great British Bake Off, and I went home for Thanksgiving, and now my mom is hooked to that show.
That makes me
what
happy.
What the heck is going on here, Matt?
What kind of Gentile nonsense is that?
No, that's not the point. It's like, why are you dropping... You're taking a bullet for Isabel.
No.
I was like taking a slow-motion butter knife for
Kelly's,
Isabel.
Kelly's not here
is
today.
Is new Kelly there?
No,
she's
not.
Where's new Kelly?
She had an issue today that she had to deal with. But I'll tell you, I'm glad she's not here because the look on her face, I can only imagine the sheer pain.
She would be crestfallen.
She would be crestfallen. Her crest would be shattered.
Listen, my whole... I'm like undone right now that I've even hurt your feelings a little bit.
What about mine?
All of yours.
Oh.
Everybody's. The last show. And my phone fell out of the window and everything's like all...
Oh, now you won't be able to listen to Serial.
Oh, my God. I just can't get myself in all these trouble
sounds
with you
like
people.
Your phone basically said just basically your phone basically just said like I can't even Isabel I can't even be around you anymore and
all
just
I do can I tell you
out
something
the
all
window.
I do is watch the Great British Bake Off and write and like try and deal with I don't even know. I'm so flustered now I can't even think.
And listen,
Isabel,
to
we've had interviews with guys in prison. Somebody just reminded me with Barrett Brown. We've had
everybody, please
the
don't
Fort
be
Dix
mean
Five.
To me.
The Fort Dix Five, for God's sakes. Oh, man. All right. Well, look, Isabel, listen. If you ever get another phone, you could put on the Majority Report app. Serial does not have an app. Just put it on your phone.
No, Serial doesn't have an app. That's why it's not the same.
I got news for you.
What?
Not only does Serial not... Let me tell you something. Serial is in the politics and news silo of iTunes. Now, put that aside, that true crime stories are in there.
I don't know anything about this. I just... Someone said listen to Serial, so I did. And I
well, I think
good
someone said to
you
a long
like
time
it.
Ago, listen to the Majority Report.
And someone else
someone
said...
was me.
And someone else said, listen to the show that you're on.
Yes, that's what
and
I'm
that
saying.
Someone was everyone else.
What?
I
want
to know who told you to listen
Michael,
to
by the way.
Who told you to listen to Serial? Who was it that had this power over you?
My upstairs neighbor.
Your upstairs neighbor? You don't even know the person's name.
He was probably at the football party.
Do you
though.
Even know their name? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's last?
I'm not going to reveal her name so you can be mean to her on national radio.
What was she? What did she do? She called you up and said, how much chicken wings should we get for the Super Bowl party that Sam's not invited to? Oh, and incidentally, you should listen to Serial. Well, of course. I always take suggestions from people that I invite to the Super Bowl party.
You know what? You guys should have more confidence in yourself.
What?
I always recommend books to other people. Doesn't mean that they don't want to read my book.
Well, but in this instance, you don't want to listen to the show. You haven't done it.
Because it's every day. I don't listen to the radio all day. I write
well, you don't
silent.
Have to listen every day. You don't get punished. We don't punish you.
Yes, you are. I am getting punished.
No, no, no. You don't get punished for just listening to one show a week.
Huh?
Hmm.
Oh.
Isabel, I didn't want
to. Now I'm
going
to have to watch like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to make me, or The Little Drummer Boy to make me feel better.
Oh, actually, in all seriousness, I would watch the movie Dope, Isabel. You'll like it. It's a very, very good movie.
Okay, is it about drugs? Because I don't like drugs.
Oh, you know what?
Not really. It's more about race and coming of age.
Isabel, you know what you
no,
should
I'd like
do?
That.
You know what you should do? You should listen to the Tim Ferriss Show. It's a podcast.
I was trying to do an olive branch, and you go right back. Michael here, by the way.
All right, I don't even know what I'm going to do. All I know is that Star Wars is going to be playing 24/7 in my house.
All right.
Now I feel badly. It's the end of the year. tried my best.
I don't even think have I seen you in 26? I didn't even think I saw you in 2015.
That's not true. It's your fault for moving to Brooklyn.
I know.
You ruined everything.
I did. Now you're not going to listen to the show.
Now?
Oh my God. Do you know how much I love the show? It's the only show I ever tweet about.
Distance makes the heart grow fonder.
Oh my gosh. You moved to Brooklyn. I don't know what to say.
All right.
You made me look like a Trump supporter in front of all of America.
You know what? You're not. No, don't say that. We know you're joking. You're not a Trump supporter. We're just a alternate podcast supporter. That's all. That's all right. I'm not going to look, you know, you attack me, I attack you back.
And, I was going to recommend Brooklyn anyway, but then you have to pay money for it.
All right. Well, now I can download it. So what do you think about that?
Well, now it's probably in your SAG thing.
I can't wait to go out and buy a bunch of tween books for Myla.
Well, no one.
I'm going to get Cloudy Night, and I'm going to get Sunny Night, and I'm going to get Misty Night. Just don't know if I can buy Starry Night because I don't want to get in trouble.
Well, no one else did either. So
what? You got to be joking.
No way.
It didn't do that well.
Wait till Myla starts reading it, and then you've got like a built-in publicity machine.
Because she's a queen bee.
Oh, my God.
She might be a queen bee.
She might be.
If if she is, then it would be good if she read it, because if she reads it, then everybody else reads it, and then it's like a...
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. She's going to read that book, and everybody's going to be reading that book. That's the way it works.
That's right. I know that's the way it works. I know.
I just got to get her to listen to the Majority Report before she listens to Serial, and then maybe we could have... Isabel Gillies, let me tell you something. I have enjoyed every time you've come on this program, not just this year, but all the years in the past, but I'm just focusing on this year because it's the end of this year, and I am looking forward to talking to you many times in 2016, and also launching the podcast that we keep talking about. That we've got
to
do.
No, it's happening.
It's happening.
That is 100% happening.
And maybe even I will pick out a couple of shows on the podcast that you might particularly like so that we could actually get you, see if we can get you interested in the Majority Report, the show that you come on a regular basis for many years.
Not likely.
Right.
Well, I love you guys very much, and I'm very grateful to be a part of the Majority Report podcast.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Isabel. Say hi to Peter and the kids.
Yeah, you too, and everybody.
Bye.
Enjoy. All right, lots of love. Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've got one more thing to do before we move into the fun half, and that is we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song of the week. Ladies and gentlemen, this song is entitled...
Ben the Republican Black Man.
Ben... The Republican Black Man.
Okay.
Well, look at
interesting ground here.
Somebody's
trying to
on.
Muscle into the Carson market, I see.
Okay.
All right.
Let's listen to that song.
Ben the Republican Black Man lives in Maryland. No longer does he chase his mom with the hammer in his hand. A famous brain surgeon. He has a blessed life. No longer tries to stab his friend with a friggin' knife. Oh, Ben the Republican Black Man runs for president. No government experience, but don't you say he can't. Yes, Ben the Republican Black Man, kinda like Herman Cain. Ben is more soft-spoken, yet Ben is more insane. Ben was asked if he was ruthless enough to do the deed of slaughtering innocent children, and Ben said yes indeed. Bombs Ben orders will inflict death and pain and strife. Yet, Ben said the unborn fetus must have the right to life. Oh, Ben the Republican black man runs for president. No government experience, but don't you say he can't. A famous brain surgeon, he has a blessed life. No longer tries to stab his friend with a friggin' knife.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. The Puff the Magic Dragon send out.
No matter stab you.
Look. I wanted to give the proper applause for and also thank Jimmy Reefer Cake, who I think has had a banner 2015 in providing us with weekly songs.
Indeed.
You know, I think it was probably in 2014 that Screaming Majority left us for a while. It's now been, I think, 2 years. So Jimmy's been holding down the fort solo style, and more or less. And I hope people go over to allthehypocrisy.com, and there's links there where you can buy Jimmy Reefercake's songs. You know, he's a part of the show that we look forward to every week. Sometimes, you know, they can't all be gems, but very often he does
very often
good
they're
job.
Gems.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, he's batting better than Ted Williams. I'll tell you that.
Who's Ted Williams?
You're joking, right?
Yeah, I'm joking.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to head into the fun half of the program on Monday when we have a better sense of what's going on. There's a lot happening in terms of this Bernie Sanders thing, and we're going into the debate this weekend. Just to be clear. The DNC is claiming that because of a failure of their vendor, I can never remember their names, but it doesn't matter. There was a vendor that provides software for voter lists. Voter lists are the key to any campaign, and what happens is these voter lists are stored with the DNC. Access and many times they are actually generated by the campaigns themselves. Not many times, they always are, but you know, overlay and stuff like that. And the vendor apparently has failed in the past to maintain the firewall between different campaigns, so that other campaigns using the same software could actually access the other campaign's data. The charge by the DNC is that the Sanders campaign downloaded information from the Clinton campaign, and therefore they're cutting off access to their own voter files to the Sanders campaign. As far as I know, the Sanders campaign claims that's not the case. One of the people who found the breach has written a piece saying that he wanted to show that he could breach in there because he was also concerned about a breach of their own information and needed to show his tracks to the vendor. He had reported this, apparently. Now, I don't know any of the people involved in this. I know at least that one person, people I trust say that this guy is very, very conscientious about this, that he was the one who was fired by the Sanders campaign. We will have more information by this on Monday, but the Sanders campaign is apparently going to go to federal court to get the DNC to release their data because they're basically their data is being held hostage, according to them, and they cannot do anything. Now, look, I don't know. I've just told you everything I know about this, and I want to read more because this has been ongoing over the course of the show before I, you know, sort of make any analysis. But one thing is clear. And I raise this only because tomorrow night we have a debate. The DNC has unequivocally been putting their thumbs on the scales. Now, they do this, obviously. They do this when they weigh in other primaries. They've done this in the past. But the bottom line is that there is no way anybody can look anybody else in the eye with a straight face and say, putting these debates on a Saturday night was anything but a means in which to bury the debates. I happen to think the theory is wrong, but it is obviously it was based upon a theory that we have a front runner. We want that front runner to win. And what you do when you are in the lead, and if you are cautious and defensive, and certainly this theory might help for the primary. I think it hurts for the general. What you do is you play a four corners, they call it in basketball. And that is you take time off the clock. If it is football, what they do is they send seven guys deep.
Prevent defense.
Prevent defense is what this is. And they call it different things in different sports. It's, you know, pitching intentional walk in baseball. Not so much because baseball is not really, there's not a clock on this. But nevertheless, this is what that strategy was. And so there is clear evidence of where the DNC and what they're doing. As far as I can tell, the response by the DNC is a huge overreaction. And one of their own vendors making. This is not, nobody's claiming that there was a hack here. People are simply claiming that a failure of the software left information vulnerable and became accessible to members of the Sanders campaign. And frankly, for all we know, could have been gone the other way too. We don't know. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. Take your phone call, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We will not be live during the Democratic debate. However, we will recap it on Monday. So, members, see you in the fun half. We'll be right back.